Oxbalm held Mountain Lake's sticky hand as they started down the beach for the bonfire, where Fernleaf and several other women knelt, chopping sun-dried meat and melting fat in soapstone bowls. As they walked, Mountain Lake collected whole horn shells and purple fragments of mussel shells. She kept all of them in her left hand, where their edges poked out between her small fingers. Oxbalm could barely make out her features through the dried blood. He ran his thumb over her cheek.
You look like you were killed by a short-faced bear and dragged around by the cats.
Yes, Grandmother and me got a lot of work done. Did you see that big pile of kidney slices we cut up?
Oh, it was huge. We'll throw them all into the fat and fry them crisp for supper tonight.
I love mammoth.
Well, this is the first time you've had it. How would you know?
We've eaten it for supper 3 nights in a row. That's enough to know.
She watched her moccasins as she walked, kicking up sand.
Quit that.
You like it, Grandfather. You know you do.
She gave him the winning smile that always melted his soul.
Oh, you're right. Go ahead.
Mountain Lake kicked up a haze of sand, and Oxbalm squeezed his eyes half closed to fend off the onslaught. Dragging her by the hand, he hiked up to the rocky terrace where the bonfire burned. Mountain Lake hesitated for a moment, then twisted her head and frowned over her shoulder.
Uh-oh, Grandfather, here comes Cat Straw, and he looks mad.
He always looks mad.
Oxbalm turned. Cat Straw strode across the sand purposefully, his gaze riveted on Oxbalm.
Mountain Lake, why don't you go ask Fernleaf for a piece of fried fat? I'll be there shortly.
Grandfather, why isn't Cat Straw happy that the mammoths gave themselves to us to eat? Doesn't he like mammoths?
I'm not sure that he likes much of anything. Go now. Run along.
Yes, Grandfather.
Reluctantly, she released his hand and raced away. Cat Straw looked determined. Oxbalm had the distinct urge to run in the opposite direction, as if his ancient legs would allow him that luxury. But he folded his arms and stood his ground. The afternoon was wearing on, and mist curled from the deep blue surface of Mother Ocean.
What is it, Dreamer?
We have to finish our discussion, Oxbalm.
I didn't think there was anything left to say.
Cat Straw propped bloody hands on his hips.
I'm growing tired of you, Elder. I have been leading the Mammoth Spirit Dance, Oxbalm, not Sunchaser. Doesn't that tell you something?
What?
That I am the new spiritual leader here. I should have some right to talk to you about matters of the clan.
Cat Straw, you know as well as I that you'll never be the spiritual leader here until more of your dreams start coming true. But you do have rights as a member of this clan. Talk. I'm listening.
No one's dreams are always accurate, Oxbalm. Not even the great Sunchasers.
Name one time that Sunchaser's dreams have been wrong.
Oxbalm, I know that you like Sunchaser. I didn't come to fight about him. I had a dream, and I wanted to tell you about it. I know, too, that you sent for Sunchaser to ask him what the drownings mean, but I already know. I was sleeping under that fir tree over there.
What dream?
Dramatically, Catch Straw spread his arms.
It came upon me in a roar like the wings of the greatest thunder beings.
The dream, Catch Straw. What did you see?
Listen for once and you'll find out. Mammoth above came to me. She said that her children killed themselves out of anger. Anger at Sunchaser because he refuses to talk to them anymore. She said the mammoths need a new dreamer to talk to.
I see. And you think you're the one?
Who else is there?
Oxbalm's lips pressed into a thin white line. For cycles, Catch Straw had been struggling to compete with Sunchaser for the spiritual leadership of the Sea Clans. Oxbalm had never taken him seriously, but he did have a point. Sunchaser's constant absences had diminished his status in the eyes of the people. If Sunchaser didn't take some action soon to repair the damage, Catch Straw might win without any battle at all.
What is it you want from me, Catch Straw?
I want you to call a council session so I can tell everyone about my dream. That's the only way they'll believe me.
How true. Without a council session, Catch Straw could recount his dream all he wanted to. but he'd been wrong so often in the past that few people would pay attention.
If I am the one to call the council for you, it will appear that I believe your dream. That's what you want, isn't it?
I just need a short session, Oxbaum. I won't take long, and in the end, my power will win out.
Oxbaum ground his gums in irritation. Some people actually believed in Catchstraw's power. If Oxbaum denied the request, it would make Catchstraw's followers suspicious and cause a rift in the clan. It might be safer to give Catchstraw the chance to make a fool of himself publicly. It would be even better if he could arrange it so that Sunchaser were present to defend himself at the session. Yes, indeed.
It is my right as a member of this clan.
Yes, yes, it is your clan right. Very well. But I can't give you a day yet. There are things I must tend to. People I must consult with before I can tell you when. And it will certainly have to be after the Mammoth Spirit gets.
But you will call the session?
As soon as I can.
Perhaps I have judged you wrongly, Elder.
Catchstraw turned and plodded away across the rocky terrace. Premonition slipped through him like an eel in a net. Oxbaum studied the man's narrow back as he walked away. Then he continued toward the knot of women and the crackling bonfire. Mountain Lake saw him coming.
Grandfather! I got us 2 pieces each!
Catchstraw sat cross-legged on a thick pile of hides in his lodge. The structure stretched 20 hands long and 15 hands wide. He'd constructed it by sinking 10 whale rib bones, 5 on each side, into holes he'd excavated with an oak digging stick. Then he'd lashed the ribs to a central ridgepole of fir with strips of raw wet leather that had shrunk as they dried. After that, he'd cajoled and bargained and bought 12 finely tanned, short-faced bear hides to cover the frame with. These he had sewn together with tendons stripped from the bones of elk and deer. The hole was large enough to house a wealthy man, his wives, and family. Had Catchstraw ever cared for such trivialities? He'd been married twice, each time as a result of his mother's efforts to arrange a good alignment with another coastal clan. In both instances, the women had left him after several days because he had pointedly ignored them. Each marriage had cost his clan dearly. Wedding gifts, so carefully negotiated, had to be returned, along with additional wealth to assuage any injured feelings. While many members of the clan, especially those whose fortunes had suffered, stared at him with resentful eyes, Catchstraw didn't mind. Such actions set him apart, distinct from the rest of his society. Dreamers were always different from ordinary people. Catchstraw's rage with Oxbaum had yet to fade.
More of my dreams will have to come true. Eh, Oxbaum? Old fool, what do you know? It's not my fault that dreaming is so hard.
For over a hand of time, Catchstraw had been staring at the irregular piece of deer hide spread across his lap. The supple hide had been tanned to a pale eggshell color, which made the black lines of Sunchaser's maze stand out. They meandered across the surface, weaving drunkenly in and around the center. Catchstraw had drawn the maze himself, had copied it exactly from Sunchaser's own. In the flickering light, the lines seemed to move, eddying back and forth in the manner of a den of newborn snakes. Catchstraw struggled to concentrate on them, but his attention wandered like the flight of a bee through a field of wildflowers.
This maze is meaningless, Sunchaser.
He flipped the hide onto the hard-packed dirt floor and rubbed his eyes.
The only thing it's done for my dreaming is to give me headaches.
For 2 cycles now, he had been trying to use the maze, but had not been able to. Sunchaser claimed that the maze described the twists and turns of the road that led to the land of the dead. Catchstraw had never even been able to glimpse the road, let alone worry about its twists and turns. Besides, his dreaming had been deepening without the maze. In the past 5 moons, he'd made monumental strides. Odd that the dreams began only after Sunchaser started missing dances and staying away from the seacoast. Perhaps Sunchaser had been doing something to hinder Catchstraw's progress? Anger seethed in his breast. Regardless, Catch Straw had learned to quiet his talkative soul, to relax his taut body. But he still felt confused and angry most of the time. He had never come close to understanding the things the great dreamers proclaimed to be true. Sunchaser, for example, said that Father Sun's light penetrated all things, even the darkest lava tubes that wound through the belly of Sister Earth, and that anyone could learn to close his eyes and see it. He said that strands of that light connected humans to all things, so that every thought, every act, affected the whole.
Pure gibberish. Sunchaser just says those things to drive people crazy.
He blinked when an idea suddenly occurred to him. For moons, he'd been trying to figure a way of getting back at Sunchaser.
So everything is connected to everything. Maybe you're right, great Sunchaser.
Catch Straw leaned forward and brushed dirt from the maze-inscribed hide, then flattened it out on the floor to scrutinize it. Shadows cast by the fire dappled the design. He pulled a stick from his woodpile and thrust the point into the flames to char. When it had a good coating of black, Catch Straw withdrew the stick and lowered the tip to the hide. With the patience of lions stalking tapir, he drew new lines, blocking old pathways, creating new twists.
This is amusing.
His actions took on an unreal quality, as if the simple movements of his hand threw him back and forth in time and carried him days, even cycles, from this place and then returned him in an instant.
So, I've never felt so much like I'm dreaming. Really dreaming.
Catch Straw took lines and turned them into spirals, or drew them straight out away from the center of the maze, where they dangled in emptiness. Euphoria possessed him. His body seemed to float on a warm cloud. The lodge grew crystal clear, the colors brightening until they dazzled, the designs on the baskets and parfleshes jumping out at him. When he thought he heard voices in the crackling and hissing of the fire, fear flushed his veins, and he forced himself to stop. He fell back against his hides.
Blessed Mother Ocean, what's happened to me? I felt as if for the first time I touched the dream world. Oh, spirits, let it happen again. Please!
The black womb jostled violently the unnamed boy. Stars shot back and forth across the sky, leaving glowing silver trails in their wakes. He could hear their voices discussing him and the blue-green world below.
It's all right, boy.
The boy searched the blackness, trying to see who had spoken to him. But he saw only the flying stars.
No, it's not all right. My mother is in very bad trouble. If I could just find a body to live in again, I could help her. And Sunchaser, he needs me too. Neither of them would have to hurt so much if they had me there to help them.
Suffering, yes. Pain is always the problem. It waxes and wanes like the face of above old man beneath the touch of Sister Earth. But the changes are not part of above old man. They are only shadows that momentarily dim his brightness. Above old man's heart doesn't change at all. You must look deeper, boy, much deeper, before you will be ready to be born again. This is the very reason you have been denied life so many times.
Stars gathered around the boy, their light hurtfully brilliant, but their warmth built a cocoon around him. Soft voices whispered in his ears, so mixed up that he couldn't make out anything they were trying to tell him. The boy bit his lip and thought about the heart of above old man, the heart beneath the shadows.
But Sunchaser, what of Sunchaser, man? Will the shadows catch him?
It's difficult to know, boy. Sometimes humans beg for battles to be taken away from them, not realizing that only in struggling with shadows is the light made manifest.
Sunchaser walked through Brushnut Village with weary determination, heading for Standing Moon's Lodge, nestled between the trunks of two giant firs. Exhaustion smoldered within his tall body like embers hidden in the ash of an abandoned hearth. His deep-set eyes had sunk so much in the past 2 weeks that they resembled black holes cut into the tan oval of his face. The buckskin of his long beaded shirt had grown stiff with dirt and sweat. Around him, the people of the village worried. The illness had been raging for half a moon, with no sign of letting up. He hesitated before Standing Moon's door. He'd been managing scarcely 2 hands of sleep a night, and he feared his legs might buckle if he didn't sit down soon.
I just need to rest for a moment. Only for a moment.
He set his healer's pack on the ground and braced a hand on the lodge's ridgepole. Good Plume, who never seemed to feel sick, stood a short distance away from Sunchaser. He smiled. Without her, he would have died long ago. His parents' lodge had caught fire in his 7th summer. They had been sleeping closest to the flames and had perished quickly. But Sunchaser's robes had lain along the back wall. He remembered waking up, coughing and choking on the smoke. He had tried to call for help, but couldn't. Frantic voices had yelled outside. Just when he'd thought he would die too, Good Plume had rushed into the blazing lodge and dragged him out onto the dew-soaked summer grass. She had covered his nose and mouth with her mouth and forced air into his spasming lungs. Days later, she had told him,
"My breath is in you now. We have shared souls. You will carry on my work. Become a mole."
She often spoke like that, in riddles he did not understand. Sometimes she drove him crazy with her curious words, but he'd come to understand. Over the cycles, when he had lived with her, she had taught him the solitary ways of the Talth Lodge, the secret society of the Steel's Light People. Good Plume had shown him how to see without eyes in the darkness. She had taught him how to call animals by their secret names, the names they knew themselves by, and to hear them call him by the name they knew him by. Animals thought of humans in very different ways. The elk called Sunchaser Wildflower Killer because he collected so many power plants in the early spring. The ravens called him That Howling Scavenger because he sang over dying people. Sunchaser smiled to himself. Yes, Good Plume had taught him many important secrets about the world. She seemed to sense his gaze, for she straightened her humped old back and stared at him. No expression crossed her age-seamed face, but her eyes had a glint like that of weasel with a cornered mouse. Her thin neck stuck out of her doeskin dress, and her long hair, yellowish in the glow of sunlight, hung like old straw over the red and blue quilled chevrons on her collar. Sunchaser met her halfway.
"Good afternoon, my mother's sister."
He towered over her like a giant. Good Plume had to tilt her head far back to look up at him, her sun-blackened face lifting to the light. She had no more room for wrinkles. Her head tottered on her frail old neck. 3 white eyes with zigzags of lightning for pupils adorned Good Plume's chin, a sign of her leadership of the Talth. Like real lightning, the yellow slashes seemed to move as she worked her lips over her toothless gums.
"Go and get some sleep before you fall over dead. You're not fully well yet."
"I'm well enough."
"Oh, you'll be of no use to anyone but the coyotes, ravens, and maggots as a corpse."
"Standing Moon begged me to come and heal her sister. I must go."
"How long has her sister been ill?"
"For 3 days."
"3. That's when most die. Her fever is bad?"
"Very bad. Standing Moon came to me a hand of time ago to say that Wooden Cup had stopped moving last night. She'd been thrashing around, shifting from burning hot to freezing cold like the others, until she went still."
"You must hurry then. But first, tell me quickly about Cedar Branch's 3 little boys. All night long, you..."
"They died. Good Plume, I couldn't do anything for them."
Good Plume's face pinched with grief. She put a gnarled hand in the middle of Sunchaser's chest and weakly shoved him toward Standing Moon's lodge.
"Come back to me when you're finished. I'm not done talking to you yet. Something is happening to power. Something is fooling with it, allowing the evil spirits who cause this illness to stalk the land and find homes in people's bodies and souls."
"I'll return as soon as I can."
Good Plume leaned on her walking stick as though she planned on waiting patiently right there. He walked back and picked up his healer's pack. Clutching it to his chest, he returned to Standing Moon's lodge and bent to the door flap.
Standing Moon?
Sun Chaser? Come, please.
He lifted the flap and ducked inside. It took his eyes a moment to adjust to the dimness. The powerful odors of sweat, urine, and sickness encircled him. He draped the flap up on its hook to open the lodge to the cool breeze. On the low benches that lined the walls, four sick people lay beneath heaps of furs. The fire in the middle of the floor had died to gray ashes, but a slight warmth still radiated from it.
Thank you for coming, Sun Chaser.
Standing Moon was kneeling on the far side of the lodge. Her hair had been cut short in mourning, accentuating the grief that strained her round face. She held her three-year-old son's hand. His fever-brilliant eyes darted about in the dimness.
How is he?
He fell ill last night. He won't eat. I went to find the spring tubers he likes so much. I walked very far from the village, Sun Chaser, but I couldn't find any. And he won't eat anything else. He shoved away the deer soup I made for him.
Standing Moon rose to her feet and wiped sweaty palms on her cat-eyed dress. Long fringes hung from her sleeves.
But it's my sister I'm most worried about.
The eyes of the sick followed Sun Chaser as he walked behind Standing Moon to the south side of the lodge. She pulled the hides away from Wooden Cup's face.
She's been like this since midnight. I think her soul has separated from her body. Can you tie it back?
If it hasn't traveled too far.
Sunchaser crouched beside the bench and unlaced his healer's pack. Wooden Cup didn't seem to notice, but stared blankly at the soot-coated ceiling. Sweat-drenched hair framed her slack face. Only 20 summers old, she looked much older. Her skin had gone sallow. Saliva dribbled from the corners of her mouth. Gently, Sunchaser used the edge of a hide to wipe it away.
Could you bring me a bowl of water and a red ember from the fire, Standing Moon? Then build up the fire. Make it hot.
Yes.
She hurried to fill an abalone shell bowl from a bladder bag and knelt to dig through the ashes until she found an ember. She scooped it out and tucked it into a wrinkle on the top of the shell. Careful not to spill the water, she walked back and handed the bowl to him before placing kindling on the tiny eyes of embers and blowing a crackling knicker alight. Sunchaser set the bowl on the bench above Wooden Cup's head. The shell's shiny interior glistened like a rainbow in the murky light. Opening his pack, he removed a white pebble and a green soapstone pipe. The face of Otter peered up at him from the pipe, as if probing his soul. He had carved the image long ago, on his first vision quest.
A sacred call I am making. A sacred call I am making. Please hear me above, old man. My people behold him in kindness. Father, son has been my strength. The thunder being shall be my road. Awaken the great white giant. Bring him down from the north. A sacred call I am making. A sacred call I am making. I ask you for your sacred breath. I add my own to yours. I add my own to yours. I add my own to yours. I add my own to yours.
Sunchaser tamped tobacco into his pipe and used a dried leaf to shove the ember into the bowl. He puffed four times to get the smoke going, then lifted the pipe to the west, where the Thunder Beings lived. Their color was black, like the storm clouds they rode. They had the power to destroy life.
Leave this one alone, Thunder Beings. Wooden Cup is not ready to go with you yet. Her family needs her too much.
Sunchaser sucked on his pipe and blew a cloud of smoke westward. Closing his eyes, he turned to the north. For a long while, he faced the land of the snows, where Great White Giant lived. Healing power came from him. The white pebble had been chipped from Giant's icy foot by a brash young trader. Sunchaser had bought it at a great cost. He'd given 4 precious moose hides for it, and had promised to visit the trader's village to teach the people the mammoth spirit dance. He'd kept his promise, and had made the journey last summer. Reverently, he took the white pebble and dropped it into the water. Silver rings rippled outward across the abalone shell bowl. Standing Moon bowed her head when he lifted his pipe again and silently begged White Giant's help in healing Wooden Cup. He blew 4 breaths of smoke to the north. Next, he faced east. Dawnchild lived there, wrapped in the red cloak of sunrise. She had the power to make people see and understand the ways of Above Old Man.
I beg you to give Wooden Cup a few more days on Earth, Dawnchild. She's been a good woman.
He turned to face south, where Summer Girl hid in a blaze of yellow light. Her warmth caused things to grow and flourish.
Summer Girl, cast your light on Wooden Cup's soul so that it can find its way back to her body and flourish again.
Sunchaser lifted his pipe to Brother Sky, then at last lowered it to Sister Earth. He took several more puffs while he waited for his prayers to reach their destination. Like calls shouted from far away, they took time. The sweet fragrance of tobacco encircled him, cleansing and purifying, almost blotting out the reek of sickness. He took from his pack his sucking bone, a long, hollow tube crafted from the tibia of a condor. The ends had been polished, and the smooth sides carefully engraved with the symbols of power. The spiral, the sunburst, the zigzag of lightning, the shapes of clouds. He pulled Wooden Cup's covers aside, lifting her dress so he could place the bone against her navel. He sucked with all his might to draw the malignancy from within her. Wooden Cup moved slightly, and Sunchaser turned to spit a mouthful of saliva into the fire, where it vanished in the leaping flames. He repeated the process at the hollow of her throat, leaving a red bruise where he had drawn out the sickness. This, too, he spat into the fire. It would be destroyed and carried away in the smoke. Laying the sucking bone down, Sunchaser puffed on his pipe, gently blowing sacred smoke over the woman. Would they work this time? What more could he do? Rising on tired legs, he rested his pipe near the abalone shell and plucked the white pebble from the water. He sprinkled Wooden Cup's face and clothing with the drips that fell from the stone. The water had absorbed the healing power contained in the pebble and would transfer it to Wooden Cup's body. Standing Moon quietly came to stand behind him. He emptied his pipe and tucked the sacred stone back into his healer's pack.
You must give Wooden Cup a drink from the abalone shell every morning, at midday, and at night. It will help her to get well.
Yes, I will do that.
She pointed to a beautiful leather bag, its sides glittering with dentalium and olivella shells.
Oh, take that, Sunchaser, for your efforts.
It's very beautiful, Standing Moon. I appreciate the generosity of your family and clan for offering it to me. For the time being, I have enough things to meet my requirements. Give it to someone who needs it. Give it in my name. The pouch's beauty will heal someone's grief.
Sunchaser picked up his pack and started to leave, but Standing Moon gripped his sleeve tightly.
Sunchaser, will you come back tomorrow to sing for my little son? He's so young,
I'll try, Standing Moon, but there are many others sick in the village, sicker than your son. You understand, don't you?
Yes, I understand. Thank you, Sunchaser.
He patted her arm.
I want you to do something for me. Will you, Standing Moon?
What is it?
You've been washing, cooking, and tending the sick for half a moon. You look like you're about to fall down every time you take a step. If I send a good plume in to watch over your family, will you try to sleep for a few hands of time? This sickness searches for the weak and the tired. We need you to stay strong.
Yes. Thank you again, Sunchaser.
He stepped over a tumbled pile of hides that had slipped from the bench to the floor, then ducked outside. Sunlight struck his eyes painfully. He paused in the shadow of the lodge. Good Plume stood where he'd left her, leaning on her walking stick. She watched him through narrowed eyes. He crossed the plaza with his pack clutched to his chest.
You wanted to speak to me, Aunt?
Goodplume nodded once, but said nothing.
I told Standing Moon that you would come to watch over her family while she slept. Is that all right?
Of course.
Good. About this sickness, this lingering evil, it's in the very...
Goodplume banged her walking stick on the ground 4 times and cocked her head in a bird-like fashion.
Do you know that there is a tribe of invisible people? They've been in this world since before Wolf Dreamer was born. They move around humans like shadows. Oh, they have bodies like ours, and they use the same tools we do, but they're not human. Where we're always laboring to see the world, they labor not to see it, but to feel it. They become visible only when they die.
I've never heard that story before, and I don't understand it. What does it mean?
Once, a long time ago, a human woman married one of the invisible men. He was a good husband. He loved her very much, went hunting every day, and they spent long hours laughing together at night. But this woman, she could not stand the thought that she didn't know what her husband looked like. So one day, when he went to sleep, she felt for his chest, took her atlatl, and drove a dart into his lungs. She got to see him all right. A handsome young man appeared. She realized too late what she had done and sobbed her heart out. In desperation, she called out to Mother Ocean for help. The mother killed the woman. Then the mother took her soul and tied it to the dead man's soul before she brought the woman to life again. So, you see, to this day, human souls are part male and part female. But the other half becomes visible only at death. How many people have died in this village?
6 today. I don't know how many in the past 2 weeks.
All women today, yes?
Yes.
I knew it. I've seen strange men wandering around all afternoon. They're lost without their female halves. Soon you must come with me, and we'll sing them to the land of the dead. Only you and I can do it. Nobody else has the power.
What would happen, my aunt, if we didn't sing for them?
Why, they'd become witches and go searching for living women to kill so they could be whole again. I have been dreaming about witches a lot lately. Maybe that's all this illness is. Male witches killing women, female witches killing men. Nobody's happy with only half a soul. You should know that. Where's that square of deer hide you always carry around? The one with the maze on it. Haven't you dreamed your way through the maze to find out what's causing this sickness?
I wanted to talk with you about that, Aunt. I'm having some trouble with the maze. Day after tomorrow, I want to go to the Dream Cave near the coast.
Trouble? Since when?
Just since yesterday. I tried to dream last night when I went out into the forest, but I couldn't. I discovered a new turn, a path I've never been on before. I keep getting lost.
Ah, that's a good sign. At least you haven't lost the ability to recognize that you're lost. Because if you did, you really would be lost.
But I end up going in circles that lead nowhere, Aunt. I fall into darkness. I think I need to be alone, so I can rest and think about it.
So, what's the problem with darkness? What happened to your eyes, Mole?
Maybe I'm just tired.
And maybe you've finished with the work of the eyes. Maybe it's time for you to do another kind of work.
What other work?
You've been laboring for cycles to see a way out for the mammoths so they can stay here with us. Maybe it's time you gave up your eyes. You must now work on not seeing. Learn to feel your way around.
You mean like the tribe of invisible people?
Yes.
And what am I supposed to strive not to see?
Your lover's face.
Sunchaser dug his fingers into the leather of his pack.
Once I've figured out what that means, I promise to work on it. Then you don't mind if I go and dream before the sickness ends?
Of course I mind, but I can do the healings that need be done. And I think I understand what's wrong with you. I had a dream. I just didn't know what it meant at the time.
A dream?
I saw you walking. You were on the hard, black road of difficulties that begins in Dawn Child's belly and arcs across the roof of the world to the home of the Thunder Beings. All humans walk this road while they're alive, of course. But you were very fortunate. You had stumbled onto the crossing that leads to the heart of the maze. Monster Rock Eagle perches in the rocks at the crossing. Very few dreamers ever see him, and he frightened you. You didn't know which direction to take, so you sat right down in the path and cried. It made me ashamed. I thought you were wiser than that.
You think the crossing is the new turn in the maze?
More likely it's the heart. Only you can figure that out.
But I want you to help me.
I can't.
Why not?
Because I don't know what it means. Except that you're in trouble. Don't you think that if I knew, I'd tell you?
Not necessarily.
Come on. We'd better sing for those half-souls right now, before the entire village has been witched and there's nobody left to sing any of us to the land of the dead.
She linked her arm through his and headed him toward the sweat lodge in the forest outside the village.
You know, Sun Chaser, I remember when you used to be happy. It wasn't that long ago, either. Remember how you used to let out those blood-curdling shrieks when power swelled your chest? Those screams warmed my heart.
I'll be happy again someday.
Of course you will. Once you've healed everybody in the world who's sick, saved mammoths, dire wolves, camels, and all the other animals who look like they're dying out, and most important of all, gone back to dreaming seriously.
Blessed spirits, I need to sit down, even if only for 50 heartbeats.
Well, we're heading in that direction. Come on.
Kestrel braced her toes on the ledge and lifted herself to peer through the pile of dead branches she had erected to block the game trail here at the edge of the cliff. She stood on a narrow ledge that stuck out like a pouting lip, 8 hands below the crest of the bluff. Cloud Girl, in her rabbit fur sack, slept next to her mother's feet. Kestrel squinted at the trail, seeing nothing, but the sound of approaching footsteps grew stronger as each moment passed. Anxiously, her eyes roved the juniper-dotted uplands. Deep drainages cut meandering swaths down the bluff, creating a series of parallel finger ridges. The bellies of the drainages were so choked with willows and cattails that they resembled green snakes slithering down the bluff toward the river. To the east, a gray haze of rain had devoured the horizon. Kestrel silently waited. Her trap had been built in 2 sections. The first blocked this main game trail that came down from the breaks and followed the canyon rim. The second section lay to the south, where 2 drainages collided. Her wing walls of brush should force her quarries into that bottleneck. If they didn't balk, if they stayed between the wing walls, they would be funneled to the edge of the sandstone cliff. Kestrel froze with excitement. Morning sunlight burned along the edges of the bluff and shimmered in the bristly fur of 2 tapirs, a cow and a yearling calf, trotting toward her on the trail. Legend claimed that tapirs were the cousins of horses, but they looked much different than horses, with long, wrinkled snouts that curved downward over their lower jaws, and squat, heavy bodies whose legs were much shorter than those of horses. They also had 4 toes on their front feet and 3 on their hind feet. Adult tapirs stood maybe 6 hands tall at the shoulder, but they were powerfully built and dangerous when threatened. Kestrel studied the cow and her calf. Odd to see tapirs in broad daylight. They clung to the night like bats and voles. Cautiously, she searched the top of the bluff for any sign of men. The only movement came from high above, where two buzzards soared on the air currents, their wings spread in such freedom that it made Kestrel's soul ache. All night long, a cold wind had blown down from the north, and this morning, ash-colored fluffs of cloud filled the sky. Could another storm be coming in so soon? Both animals stopped. The cow lifted her head and sniffed the wind when she saw the barricade. Kestrel barely breathed. The cow shied, pranced nervously, and stopped again. The calf, curious, stepped forward. It cocked its head and twisted one ear, wondering at the new sight on the familiar trail.
Please, a buffalo man, let them veer southward to take the trail where I have my trap set.
After a few moments, the calf trotted off down the southward trail. Kestrel's heart leaped. The cow lifted a front foot, peered intently at Kestrel's hiding place, then hesitantly followed her calf. But she kept looking back, forcing Kestrel to stay hidden until they had moved out of sight over the rounded crest of the bluff. Kestrel picked up the small pack she'd woven out of strips of juniper bark and yucca fibers and tied it around her waist. It carried the few necessities she'd been able to find along the riverbank. Then she looked at Cloud Girl. Gray tufts of fur framed her beautiful 4-day-old face. The pacifier that Kestrel had made from the soft underbelly of a field mouse lay halfway out of Cloud Girl's mouth. Kestrel quickly slung the sack's hide carrying thong around her neck and scrambled over the lip of stone to follow the tapers. As she ran, her heavy breasts cushioned Cloud Girl's head. Ice Plant's face flitted through her mind, and Kestrel had to shove the image away to keep her feet moving. Thoughts of him left her trembling. Despite her exhaustion, nightmares had tormented her sleep.
Not now! Don't think about it now!
When Kestrel crested the bluff, darting from scrubby tree to scrubby tree, she could see the tapers trotting along the next rise. She hastily crouched behind a juniper, peering through the scaly, needled branches, and waited until the pair had gone down the other side. The pungent sweetness of the tree lingered in her nostrils, fresh and vigorous. If she spooked the tapers now, they might break to the right, or worse, to the left, and double back to escape.
Let's give them a little more time, Cloud Girl. We want them to feel safe when they come to the brushwing walls.
Kestrel had spent an entire day building her trap. She'd twisted sage out of the ground and gathered dead juniper limbs so she could pile them into a long V that progressively narrowed as it neared the face of the cliff, a place where the hard sandstone had been undercut by the wind and weather. The drop was short, barely 20 hands, but it should do the job. She would have to frighten the animals enough to get them running and then force them into that desperate leap over the edge. If she could do that, she would have what she needed for crossing the swollen river.
Enough! Let's go!
She sprinted down the game trail behind the tapers. Her insides still ached, and every time her foot landed, a sharp pain lanced her abdomen. But she had to keep running. She had to kill at least one of the tapers. Too much time had passed while she had been trapped by the river's swirling floodwaters. Despite the pain, she clutched her daughter against her chest and ran down the dip, up the rise. Before she reached the summit, she slowed and crept up the slope to peer over the crest. The tapers had unwittingly trotted down the trail between the wing walls. But if she didn't do something fast, they would come to the place where the trail vanished, veering southward. There, the brush walls funneled them over unmarked stone toward the cliff. Unlike the mountain sheep, who would panic at the obstruction, the tapers would lower their heads and bowl their way through the walls to stay on the trail. Kestrel picked up her pace and charged over the top of the bluff. When she reached the wing walls, she swerved and sprinted down the trail behind the tapers. The cow heard her coming and bellowed a warning as it wheeled to face her. The calf danced sideways to see the problem. When it spied Kestrel, it galloped headlong down the brush walls, not stopping until it reached the cliff. Kestrel lifted her arms as she dashed headlong down the slope. The cow lowered her head and stood pawing the stone with gleaming eyes.
Cat, run! Run, mother! Run! Hurry! Run!
The cow stood her ground. A single butt from that thick skull would send Kestrel sprawling to the ground, where she would be trampled. She kept running. The cow laid her ears back and took a few threatening steps. Kestrel pulled a juniper branch from the wing walls and slapped the brush as she continued forward.
Yeah, 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 yeah! Run!
The cow sidestepped uncertainly, her coarse hair standing on end. Then she took a step backward, and finally she whirled to trot after her calf. Kestrel ran with all her might, dashing down the narrowing walls behind the cow, beating the brush with her branch. The cow reached the cliff, where the calf had stopped to peer over the edge. Frightened, the cow tried to slow her headlong rush, but her feet skidded on the loose gray dirt. She struck her calf in the haunches, spinning it sideways, and they both toppled over the cliff. Kestrel stopped running, unslung the rabbit fur sack from around her neck, and hung it on one of the branches protruding from the wing wall. On the balls of her feet, Kestrel inched forward to peer down, careful of the slick surface. Both the cow and the calf had died instantly, their necks broken in the fall.
Oh, forgive me, Mother.
Kestrel backtracked to a low place where the descent was less treacherous, moved a juniper stump, and eased her way over the cliff. The coppery scent of blood blended with the musk of taper to fill the air. Kestrel stepped over the dead cow and calf. She sank down by that big bloody head and gently patted the black hair, so stiff and warm to the touch.
I had no choice, Mother. Bless your hide to my use. You will give life to my baby and to me. We will never stop singing your praises to above old man.
Kestrel leaned her shoulder against the bluff while she untied the pack from around her waist. Here in the sun, it was pleasant to clear her mind of any sensation but the warm hide under her calloused fingers. If only she could stay like this forever, with the warmth of the sun beating down on her and the satisfaction of fresh meat for her hungry belly. But a chill like Winter Boy's shadow stole into her heart. She could feel Lambkill's presence, sense him staring at one of her tracks, reaching down to press the rain-spattered soil with a finger to test its age. Kestrel climbed back up over the ledge and pulled her daughter's sack from the wing wall where she had left it. Then she edged her way down to the tapers again.
Oh, sit here in the sun beside me, my daughter. Smell the rich sweetness of taper blood. Tonight we will both be full and happy.
Kestrel leaned Cloud Girl's cradle board up against the rocks and opened her pack to pull out the quartzite cobble she had taken from the riverbed, a black and white nice hammerstone, a flat piece of red sandstone, and two yellow blossoms she'd picked from an early blooming desert primrose. Carefully, she plucked the petals from the blossoms and placed them over the cow's and the calf's eyes. It would have been cruel to let them watch each other's dismemberment. Now they would see only a glorious yellow, as if Father Sun himself had descended from the sky to take their souls to the land of the dead. Kestrel gripped her hammerstone and steadied the quartzite cobble so that the blows would drive off the correctly shaped flakes. She had to skin the animal in the round, or it wouldn't be suitable for inflating and floating in the river. That meant she had to keep any long cuts to a minimum, since every cut would have to be sewn closed again, and each puncture she made with her bone awl would be another opening that water might seep through. The inflated hide had to be perfect, or both she and Cloud Girl would drown. Cloud Girl had fallen fast asleep in her rabbit fur sack. As Kestrel got to work unskinning the tapers, her thoughts returned to Lambkill.
Where is Lambkill? Where is he? Why hasn't he already tracked me to the river?
All morning she had expected to see him trotting over the bluff or down along the shoreline. Surely he would have left the village immediately after she ran away, wouldn't he? Or would he have waited until the storm broke before setting out on her trail? Was he so confident that he could find her?
Yes, of course he is. Because he will.
An image of his gloating face formed on her closed eyelids. It changed as she watched, shifting to different times in their life together. One image lingered from cycles ago. Lambkill still had black in his hair, and wrinkles hadn't cut such deep furrows across his forehead yet. He stood before her, trim and athletic, with muscular arms, and dressed in a beautiful golden elk-hide shirt. Yes, 5 cycles ago.
I was 13 summers old.
The It was during the Moon of New Horns at her best friend Waxwing's marriage. Kestrel had been Lamkill's wife for 2 moons. She had still felt giddy with excitement at being wanted by a man 3 times her age, a man whose reputation as a great trader spanned the world. He'd been kind to her, showering her with wondrous gifts, the like of which she'd never imagined. She'd helped Waxwing dress, then ducked out of her lodge and walked into the plaza toward Lamkill. He stood near the central cook fire, watching the hindquarter of a shrub ox roasting, suspended above the flames. Lamkill was regaling a group of young men with tales from his travels. They stood around listening with rapt expressions. Pride swelled Kestrel's chest. When she joined Lamkill, he smiled and slipped his arm around her waist to hold her close. His hand on her hip felt so comforting. She remembered gazing up at him as though he were above old man himself and hoping that he would never tire of her. More than anything in the world, she wanted to please him. As more people arrived for the marriage and joined the circle around the cook fire, cousins from distant villages came over to greet Kestrel. She smiled and laughed a great deal as she related the news and told stories about herself and Waxwing, pranks they had pulled when they'd been children. Waxwing ducked through her lodge door and began the marriage walk down the middle of the village to meet her husband-to-be, Antlertine. Everyone followed. The crowd stopped at the foot of the craggy red cliffs west of the village and looked up as Waxwing and Antlertine climbed to meet old Porcupine, who draped the white marriage hide over their shoulders. Lamkill had given Waxwing the gorgeous abalone shell pendants that hung from the edges of the hide and glittered pink in the fading afternoon sunlight. Kestrel smiled and clapped her hands when Waxwing knelt and began singing the Link Hand song.
Link hands, with me now. Link hands, with me now.
To get a better look, Kestrel stepped sideways several paces away from Lamkill. People filled in the opening she'd left, and she lost sight of him. She raised herself on her tiptoes to watch Waxwing over the shoulders of 2 men. One of the men, 2 or 3 summers older than she and very handsome, turned to look at her. He smiled. Kestrel, feeling joyous, returned the smile.
You're Waxwing's best friend, aren't you?
Yes. We've been friends since we were 4 summers old.
I thought so. I'm Waxwing's cousin, Snowwind. Didn't you just get married to the trader, Lamkill?
Oh, yes. He's over there somewhere.
Oh, he's a very great man. He used to run the trading trails with my grandfather, Looncry. I've heard stories of Lamkill all my life. You're very lucky to be his wife.
Yes, thank you. I know.
Waxwing stood up, and Kestrel shifted, trying to see better, and tripped over a stone. Snowwind politely grabbed her hand to steady her. That's when Lamkill came through the crowd looking for her, smiling and talking to people on the way. When he saw her holding Snowwind's hand, he halted abruptly. Kestrel turned, smiling as she reached out for her husband. But Lamkill stood as still as a carved soapstone statue. His gaze went from her to Snowwind and back again. His expression had gone from that of a loving husband to that of a dangerous enemy in less than a heartbeat. In dismay, she jerked her hand from Snowwind's and stood rooted to the ground. Lamkill came forward, stood between her and Snowwind.
Your grandmother Willowstem has been looking for you, Kestrel. Go find her.
Where is she? I haven't...
I said for you to go find her.
Yes. Yes, I will.
Kestrel ran through the crowd, only to discover that Willowstem had not been looking for her at all. So confused that she didn't know what to do, she started to cry. Tears ran down her cheeks as she shouldered her way back, looking for Lamkill. By the time she found him, darkness had grown up around the edges of the village. A translucent blue light suffused the sky. Lamkill had been standing with old Porcupine, but when she got close enough, he roughly grabbed her hand.
Good night, old Porcupine.
Then he dragged her back toward their lodge in the juniper grove.
Lamkill, you're hurting me. Please.
You have been my wife for 2 moons, and already you're throwing yourself at other men.
That's not true. I didn't. Snowwind was...
Lamkill leaned down, his nose only a handbreadth from hers.
Listen to me, woman.
My last wife tried to run away from me. Do you know where she is now?
She's dead. She died from a fever.
She's dead, all right.
He slowly straightened up, a triumphant, gloating expression on his face.
No woman betrays me and gets away with it.
But Lamkill, I've done nothing. I love you. I don't...
Move!
Lamkill brutally shoved her along the path and into the deep shadows of the juniper grove. They reached their lodge. Lamkill pushed her through the hide door curtain so hard that she toppled across their mammoth hide robes. The long silken fur cushioned her fall, but it still hurt. She stayed on her stomach, afraid to move. Parfleshes lined the walls, and painted hides decorated every wall, depicting hunting scenes.
Lamkill, please! I didn't mean to do anything wrong!
Lamkill draped the door curtain carefully over its antler hook, making sure that nothing blocked the cold wind that swept up the slope.
Roll over.
Kestrel obediently responded and rolled to her back. He fell on her, ripping at her sleeves, pulling them down so they trapped her arms at her sides. He fumbled with one hand to unlace his pants.
Lamkill, you don't have to do this. I want you.
He forced her knees open, bracing his hands by her hips. He entered her and thrust violently, trying to hurt her.
Please!
Shut up!
As his frenzy built, he gripped Kestrel's shoulders so hard that his fingernails cut into her flesh. Finally, he relaxed. A few moments later, he slid off her and laced his pants again. In silence, he crawled to the opposite side of the lodge and slumped down on one of the cattail sleeping mats. Within a single finger of time, he was asleep. Kestrel lay unmoving, dazed, hurting inside. She felt as though her soul had separated from her body and floated near the smoke hole in the ceiling. Kestrel shook the memory out of her head.
Never again. I'll kill him first.
Water pooled, sparkling clear in the small hollow ringed by moss-covered logs. A mat of needles and rosebush leaves coated the bottom of the catchment. Sunchaser dropped his pack to one side and studied the little creek fed by runoff. The black dog, whom he had named Helper, stepped forward on hesitant feet, sinking into the moss before lapping eagerly at the water. The trail crossed the creek here. A man traveling alone was fair game. Bears would be emerging from their winter's stupor, hungry for the lush spring grass and any other food they could find. The roaring of the lions had awakened Sunchaser that very morning, the sound muted by the trees but telling of empty bellies. From the time Sunchaser had left Brushnut Village, his fear had been increasing. When he blanked his mind, he could sense wrongness, a creeping blackness easing over the land like a perverted night fog.
Jumpy, I'm still not well. That's all. A bit of leftover fever.
He sank down onto the chilly, damp soil. His tired legs trembled, and he closed his eyes, happy to rest for a moment. Everything was going wrong. First, his dreams of the mammoths dying, vanishing from the face of the earth. Then, the way through the maze had slipped from his clumsy fingers like a wet fish. In the beginning, he hadn't been worried. Power shifted and fluctuated throughout a man's life. It should have been a simple matter to refocus his efforts and find the way. He'd left Brushnut Village 3 days ago and had been dreaming every night, but he hadn't been able to find the path through the maze. Sunchaser opened his eyes, aware that Helper had finished lapping up the cool water and come to stand beside him. Absently, he reached out, rubbing the dog's black coat. His hands were immediately coated with coarse black hair.
Oh, Helper.
Sunchaser met Helper's concerned brown gaze.
Everything is going wrong, old friend. The mammoths are dying, sickness stalks the land, and I can't even find the power to tie your hair to your body. Do you think so? I wish I had your confidence in me. I know. We'll go to the Dream Cave, where we'll have the solitude we need to find the way. You'll help me, won't you? Yes, I knew you would. The cave isn't more than a day's walk from here. We'll build a big fire. Then I'll sweat and pray.
Sunchaser leaned forward, bending down to drink, and stopped short. His image stared back at him from the calm water. The interlacing branches of the fir trees overhead made a background for his face. Aged now, lined where it hadn't been lined only weeks before. But the greatest shock was something else. Fear pumped through his muscles as he jerked out a strand of his own hair. The reflection in the pool hadn't lied. His hair was turning snow white.